This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. In just a few minutes, we're going to talk about the unspeakable. Why do humans shy away from talking about climate change? In the workplace, at family dinners, all around, we instinctively sense the unfolding tragedy of global warming isn't a welcome topic of conversation. Lifetime environmental activist and human rights campaigner George Marshall will join us from Wales in the UK. His new book is titled, Don't Even Think About It, Why Our Brains Are Wired to Ignore Climate Change. That's going to be a fascinating ride from the Texas Tea Party to why we lie to ourselves. Don't miss it. But first, I know Radio EcoShock is one place we can talk about climate change. There is huge news coming from fires in the United States, Canada, and Russia. Fires so many and so large this spring and summer of 2014 may be the largest fire season ever. They create their own local weather systems and have rapidly become a chain reaction of carbon that could trigger changes to the world weather we've barely imagined. Right about now, in the middle of July 2014, much of the Northern Hemisphere is covered with a blanket of smoke. It's smoky in the valley outside my door from the forest fires in British Columbia and eastern Washington state. There's a smoke haze over Edmonton and western Canada from all the fires further north. In fact, those smoke particles have blown 5,000 miles further east, reaching the Great Lakes and cities like Toronto. It's not just Canada. Over at the Weather Underground, Jeff Masters and his crew have posted a video showing a blackened haze pouring from numerous fires in hot, drought-stricken western states all the way to the Great Lakes and into Ohio. According to a NASA map released July 18th, the smoke has even reached Maryland, West Virginia, and Tennessee. All this is a danger to people's health, especially to the millions of new cases of asthma springing up across America and around the world. There is even a thick black arm of smoke running up to the Arctic, to Hudson's Bay and Baffin Island. It's starting to reach Greenland, and that's not good. And that isn't the worst of it. More gigantic fires are racing uncontrolled across the Canadian tundra in the Yukon. These are beasts that reach from the treetops to the deep peat below the soil surface. These are the most powerful fires seen in decades in the north. The smoke clouds look like volcanoes have erupted. 31 new fires popped up in a single day, with at least 2,500 fires this year, and almost 3 million acres burned so far. Canadian authorities report the area burning is 6 times greater than the 25-year average. The dean of Canadian wildfire experts is Dr. Michael Flanagan, a professor of wildland fire at the University of Alberta's Renewable Resources Department. I've recorded and played you his talk at the American Academy for the Advancement of Science Conference in Vancouver in 2012, and I broadcast it April 18th of that year. I've interviewed him directly for this program. Then, and now to the media, he emphasizes, quote, what we're seeing in the Northwest Territories this year is an indicator of what to expect with climate change. Expect more fires, larger fires, more intense fires, end quote. I've put out a video about all that on YouTube. Check it out. It's called The Age of Superfires. Now, some of these blazes are so hot they sterilize the ground. In some places, Flanagan says, the slow-growing boreal forest may not ever return, especially after multiple burns. In just a minute, I'm going to explain why this growing trend to a burning subarctic, and especially this year, is a danger to us all wherever you live on the planet. But first, let's escape the North American news lens to get the other part of this story. Siberia is burning again. The year 2012 was a terror for forest fires in the Russian subarctic. The Russian authorities admit 548 wildfires that year with the loss of 22,500 hectares. The reality may have been much greater than what they're telling us. As of July 10, 2014, the ITAR-TASS news agency reports 13,500 hectares burned. It's so dangerous, local authorities in Siberia have banned residents or anyone from going into the woods. You can see this giant cloud cover, and it's from smoke, covering large parts of eastern Asia and the north. According to the Moscow Times on July 18th, the size of fires in the Buryatia region doubled overnight. The Siberian Irkutsk region already declared a state of emergency in May as fires raged there, pretty early for that fire season. Once again, the particles from these fires will rotate around the upper northern hemisphere and around the world. So let's review some basic facts, shall we? Due to our carbon emissions and increasing methane emissions in the Arctic, heating in the polar and subpolar regions is the fastest on Earth. It was tens of degrees warmer in Alaska last winter, and tens of degrees warmer than the average from around 1950 for the whole Canadian subarctic and for much of Siberia this spring and summer. The Yukon has seen temperatures you might expect in a Colorado summer. Like the American West, it's been abnormally dry in the Canadian Northwest as the slower jet stream seems to freeze into a constant weather-blocking pattern. Being the Arctic, there are collisions with colder air masses, and from that, lots of thunderstorms. Lightning sets the tinder below ablaze. As Mike Flanagan told us on Radio EcoShock, the thinner subarctic soils dry out amazingly quickly. Just 3 days after a rainstorm, the soils can be tinder dry in hot weather, and they are getting plenty of hot weather. There are so many reasons why these fires are really a global climate emergency. You know boreal forests were carbon sinks, soaking up a lot of our excess carbon and storing that CO2 in the woody fiber of the trees. But when they burn like this, boreal forests reverse that process, releasing CO2, loading the atmosphere. Add methane coming from both melting permafrost on land and shallow seabeds in the Arctic Sea, and we get localized warming. That's the positive feedback effect, the way the Arctic climate is spiraling out of control into warming never known during the time of humans on this planet. That extra heat melts more sea ice, which exposes more dark oceans to the summer sun's 24-hour rays, making the ocean hotter, eating away at the edges of glaciers, speeding up ice loss, and so it goes. There's another even more serious threat here. Some scientists have reported that up to half of all melting of glaciers and snow in places like Greenland and the Arctic comes from the deposition of black particles falling out of the atmosphere. Some of that is our urban pollution wafting north, captured by the winds circling toward the cooler poles. They call it dark snow. The darker the color, even if it's just a shade of gray, attracts much more heat from the sun than a pure white snow would. The same effect has been measured by scientists in the Rocky Mountains. Black particles, mostly from Asian coal burning, turn snow a grayer color, resulting in earlier spring melts, a longer fire season, and more forest fires in North America. You can see how it works. Carbon soot bounces around the world, creating more warming, creating more carbon soot, creating more warming. With that extra heat in the Arctic, more ice melts, which will speed up the sea level rise around the world. You may be on a low-lying delta in Bangladesh or coastal Australia and still get the extra sea rising due to these faraway subpolar fires. Underlying much of this, says one of my favorite bloggers, Robert Scribbler, is the change in the polar jet stream. Let me read from Robert's blog posted July 17, 2014. Potential amplifying feedbacks in context. During recent years, scientists have been concerned by what appears to be an increasing waviness and northward retreat of the northern hemisphere jet stream. This retreat and proliferation of ridge and trough patterns is thought to be a result of a combined loss of snow and sea ice coverage over the past century and increasing over the past few decades. In 2012, sea ice coverage fell to as low as 55% below 1979 levels, with volume dropping as low as 80% below previous values. Over the past 7 years, not one day has seen sea ice at average levels for the late 20th century in the north. Meanwhile, northern polar temperatures have risen very rapidly under the rapidly rising human greenhouse gas heat forcing, increasing by 0.5 degrees centigrade per decade, or about double the global average. It is this combination of conditions that set the stage for fixed ridges over both Russia and Canada, creating extreme risk for extraordinary fires. Should both the current sets of fires continue to rage under anomalous high-amplitude jet stream waves, setting off extreme heat in these Arctic regions, it is possible that large clouds of heat-absorbing black carbon could ring the Arctic in a kind of hot halo. The dark smoke particles in the atmosphere would trap more heat locally, even as they rained down to cover both sea ice and ice sheets. With the Canadian fires, deposition and snow darkening are a likely result, especially along the western regions of the Greenland ice sheet, zones that have already seen a multiplication of melt ponds and increasing glacial destabilization over recent years. And though climate models are in general agreement that the frequency of fires in tundra regions will increase, doubling or more by the end of this century, it is uncertain how extensive and explosive such an increase would be given the high volume of fuel available. Direct and large-scale burning of these stores, which in the tundra alone house about 1,500 gigatons of carbon, could provide a major climate and Earth system response to the already powerful human heat forcing. Well, that's a just wonderful writing by Robert Scribler, and it shows that this Arctic fire situation could bounce back on a global scale. Find links to these articles and to Robert Scribler's blog and my show blog at ecoshock.info. Robert Scribler adds this as an update, quote, atmospheric black carbon and methane loading, more in a new post, likely contributed to temperatures in the range of 95 degrees Fahrenheit, 35 degrees C, near the shore of the Arctic Ocean's Laptev Sea yesterday, as recorded in the following screen capture from a certain satellite. End quote. Now, when the high Arctic is 95 degrees, 6 degrees hotter than the same day in Richmond, Virginia, we can truly say the roof of the world is on fire. We are in it now. Global warming is feeding itself with multiple feedbacks, and the big action is thousands of miles away from you, far from the big city news cameras, and from all the trash filling our airwaves and our minds. As climate disasters continue to unfold, most of us are not even paying attention. Radio EcoShock listeners are, and it's up to us to spread the word, starting those difficult conversations that nobody wants to talk about. Stay tuned as George Marshall tells us why it is hard and how to do it. Scientists warn we are headed into catastrophic climate change never before seen during human existence on this planet. Yet the most alarming facts seem hardly to touch the lives of most people. We go on as usual. Author George Marshall found out why he says our minds are programmed to ignore climate change. Now, George is an old-school environmentalist, having worked as a senior campaigner for both Greenpeace in America and the Rainforest Foundation. In 2004, he co-founded a charity based in Oxford, UK, called the Climate Outreach and Information Network. They specialize in reaching all sorts of organizations, from churches to service clubs, scouts, trade unions, you name it. Well, now he's written a new book called Don't Even Think About It, Why Our Brains Are Wired to Ignore Climate Change. From Britain, actually from Wales, George Marshall joins us now. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, and thanks for having me on, Alex. I really appreciate it.
Well, I've been wanting to talk to you for a while, so this is a good occasion. Now, after campaigning on the biggest story ever, you must have been frustrated about why the global warming message is so hard to communicate. Is that what got you started on this trek?
I think it was the awareness that I just kept talking to the same people, and that if I held an event, I could predict, if I was an artist, I could even draw what they would look like, and they would turn up every time. And that's not to say that the other people out there didn't believe in climate change, but there was something which had happened where we just kept talking within the same group. And I became keenly aware, as you said, Alex, like having worked with in the environment movement my whole life, that there were so many people that we were not in any way engaging. And on some issues, that doesn't matter so much, but on this issue, we really have to reach out wider. I think the other thing was that increasingly we found that it's become so polarized politically. So in a recent poll actually done in New Hampshire and the States, they found that climate change was a better indicator of people's politics than any other issue. So that even these absolutely hot-button issues like abortion, gun control, capital punishment, even those were less indicative of people's politics than climate change. And the difference there is that left-wing people now say climate change is a huge and major threat, and right-wing people increasingly say that don't believe it, or say it's been exaggerated, or say it's all natural. And that then has led me increasingly into trying to find ways of speaking with conservatives about it. This increasingly put me in a situation of saying, look, clearly, just talking about the information, just saying, look, this is what the scientists say, look, this is so serious, we have to do something about it, just doesn't seem to work. And that those people who don't believe in climate change, they are just as intelligent, just as educated. In fact, actually, strangely, some evidence finds that they know slightly more about science than the people who do believe in climate change. So there's nothing going on there. There has to be something in the story and the way that we tell the story. And I guess, as I talk about in the book, there has to be something peculiar about this issue, too, that means we don't get it straight away. There has to be something in here that allows us to push it on one side and just say, okay, that sounds bad, and yet somehow not quite to believe it.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. You know, we have a lot of scientific proof, mountains of it, and it's not enough to sway government or a lot of people. So is there a role for psychology or perhaps even psychiatry in our willful blindness about carbon pollution?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about that. When I started asking these questions back in 2000, there was actually very little attention from psychologists. The general opinion was that it was just a matter of time and everything was tipping. Now there's been a lot of attention. The American Psychological Association has done several huge papers on this, and there's been a lot of focus because a number of psychological patterns operate through this issue. One of the things is that it certainly causes anxiety. The messages and the stories, and of course increasingly what people are experiencing around them to in their own lives and weather and to landscapes and ways of life that are very much important to people. This causes distress in various ways, not least, of course, if you're caught up in a major extreme weather event. But I think it's also clearly the case that climate change is an issue which is a very, very hard one for us to deal with, because it does not contain the triggers that we require for identifying major threats. I mean, if you think about it and you look at how we have developed and evolved as a species, we have a number of things which immediately get us to respond. Things which are visible, things which are posing a direct personal threat, especially things where we can see that there is a direct threat and what the cause of that threat is, and if that threat is an enemy, an identifiable enemy, something we know has an intent to cause us harm. All of these things immediately click in our fear and our threat mechanisms. Of course, climate change doesn't have these. In fact, I've come to the conclusion the biggest problem with climate change is that it actually doesn't contain a clear external enemy. We would respond, let's put it this way, Alex, if the CIA, okay, if the drones or whatever, the intelligence people found out that the weather was changing, they found out that the reason for that was that North Korea was pumping gases into the atmosphere with the intention of destabilizing the world's weather patterns and inducing drought across California. It would actually be a very simple issue. It would be a horrible issue. It would be the same issue, but it would be very different in terms of how we responded to it, because we'd say, well, there's an enemy. They intend to threaten us.
Well, it's tough because, you know, as you say, the if it was the Taliban, we'd probably do something. But in fact, we are the climate terrorists. We're flying around. We're burning all this energy. So it's hard to find out that we are the enemy of a stable climate.
And talking about us as the enemy doesn't quite fit either. I mean, even as a climate change campaigner, I can't think of my friends and my family and people who are flying, I don't know, to go and visit a friend or to go and have a holiday. I can't think of them as an enemy or even damaging the world, because there isn't the intention to cause harm. That missing component is intentionality is a fundamental component of how we weigh up ethics. And it's well proven in psychological experiments that even children as young as three can actively differentiate between somebody who causes them harm by an accident and somebody who causes them harm through the intention to cause harm. So these perceptions of threat and these perceptions of what is right and what is wrong are very, very deeply embedded. And of course, if you do accept climate change, as most people do at some level, it puts you into a situation being faced up with that moral responsibility. And that's a very heavy burden to carry. And what I think is interesting with climate change as an issue is not that people deny it. As we know, there's a small percentage of people who say, yes, it's a complete myth, I don't accept it. But actually, that the majority of people accept it, and if you say, is it a problem, they'd say, yes, it's a serious problem, and yet they manage to push it on one side. So we find repeatedly in opinion polls, if you ask people, if you give them a leading question, is climate change a problem, the majority of people say yes. And in fact, a lot of those will say a very serious problem. If you go on and you ask people, tell me what you think the greatest problems are that we face, very, very few people mention climate change. So it's kept in this kind of limbo. As a problem that people know is there, as a problem which if you were to ask them why it's a problem, they'd immediately start telling you what a serious problem it is, and yet it just doesn't engage with their normal life. And I think that's because of this this internal moral challenge. It's almost too difficult to think about.
And as you've pointed out, it's not polite to talk about climate change at a gathering like a dinner party, and that's so strange, this social agreement to keep quiet about it. How does that work?
In the course of writing the book, I had the huge privilege of being able to go and speak with some of the leading thinkers in the world in psychology, cognitive psychology. I had a very interesting conversation with Professor Eviata Zerubbabel, who's a professor of sociology, actually, at Rutgers University in New Jersey in the States. And Eviata is a very interesting character because he is the world's leading expert on the social construction of silence. It was actually one of the things most interesting about studying climate change is I kept coming back to how the really interesting questions were not with what something was, but what it was not. So what people did not say, what people did not think, what people did not worry about, rather than what they did. And this very much applied to silence. Now, Professor Zerubbabel says that not only is there a silence where people don't talk about things, but there is a meta-silence. And a meta-silence is an inability to even talk about why you don't talk about something. And in his view, climate change fits that pattern. But not only do we not talk about climate change, but that we are incapable of even fully explaining why we don't talk about it. It's an advanced sociological condition which you get in conditions where people feel morally challenged or compromised. I mean, the classic case and where the most research has been done is in places where there's severe human rights abuses going on. So, for example, I mean, at its worst case, if you were in Stalinist Russia or Nazi Germany, people just disappearing in the night. People learnt that there were things they wouldn't even notice, that they wouldn't talk about, that things were not discussed. You did not talk about what had happened. And you find this throughout the world now, places which have had collective trauma. People know that there's things simply not to talk about, but it's out of the bounds. It's a bit weirder with climate change because, climate change is not a human rights abuse in that sense. I mean, I think it's actually the biggest human rights crime in human history, but not in the sense that, you know, you're going to get beaten up or killed if you notice it. But it is similar in the sense that there is a social agreement. And we know this from asking people how often you talk about climate change. We know that a third of people have never had a conversation about climate change with anyone. Two-thirds of people virtually never talk about it with anyone apart from their closest friends and family. And weirdly, if you ask people how much they talk about climate change, people hugely overestimate, usually by a factor of two or three, how much they actually talk about it compared with how much they really do. What I found most interesting was going into areas that had had extreme weather events, one of which was areas in New Jersey where Hurricane Sandy had just flattened whole swathes of a housing property along the coast, and just asked people, could you tell me the last time you talked about climate change? And nobody I spoke to could remember the last time that they had had a conversation about climate change in relation to the storm that had completely demolished their towns scarcely 6 months previously. Now, when I pressed them on it, I said, why haven't you talked about it? Of course, then there's a meta-silence. People can't fully explain it. But what they can say is it just felt inappropriate. It didn't feel right. It felt wrong. And I guess what I'm saying is, well, if people who have just had their lives destroyed by an extreme, and in some cases, sort of beyond the bounds of historical record, weather event, and I found this in other places where this had happened, and they can't talk about climate change, and if people who are just getting on with their daily lives and therefore they're not having extreme weather, they're not talking about climate change, well, who is ever going to talk about it? And of course, if you don't talk about it, it doesn't exist. If it's not something which is considered a thing that you could talk about at dinner or with your friends when you're having a drink or with somebody in a shop or with your best friend, And actually, interestingly, the people who speak the least about climate change are younger women with children. So there's some groups, I mean, they hardly talk about it at all. If none of these people are talking about it, it simply doesn't exist because it's nowhere, is nowhere in our conversations.
You know, I have a parallel with the Holocaust, the murder of millions by Nazi Germany. And, you know, growing up in North America as a child, I never heard about it. I discovered it from a book, not from my parents or teachers or anyone else. Nobody ever discussed it. It didn't exist until, you know, the late 60s. People started to become aware of it. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith talking with George Marshall about his new book, Don't Even Think About It, Why Our Brains Are Wired to Ignore Climate Change. The Climate Outreach and Information Network has been trying all along to get this message out. How have you fared with the trade union movement?
Trade unionists absolutely should be involved with this. They are, of course, on the left politically. They are progressive. They should be at the forefront of issues that involve people coming together. In fact, we called our campaign that we worked with them Climate Solidarity. So this idea that people often feel powerless in the face of climate change as an individual, but of course trade unions are built on the principle that we all pull together in the same direction. That's how we get change. And I have to say trade unions are doing better on this. When I first started looking at trade unions, which would have been about 10 years ago, they were not involved at all. And I think they are better now. I don't know how it is for you in Canada. Here in Britain, the trade unions are sort of involved. But I think that the problem that happens with them, and most definitely happens with human rights organizations, who, again, my organization has worked a lot with, is that they come to define this issue as being an environmental issue. And they say, well, yes, we care about the environment, and that's important, but that's not our core concern. I did some research 6-7 years ago to try and work out why it was that none of the human rights organizations were talking about climate change. And extraordinarily, Amnesty International, so the most famous human rights organization in the world, at that time had not one single mention of climate change anywhere on its website. You could do a Google search of a whole website, and the phrase climate change or global warming did not appear once, which I found extraordinary. Actually, at the same time, but other organizations, including the Red Cross, were saying that this was potentially the greatest generator of future human rights abuse and future conflict. And it wasn't there. And when I talked to senior people in it, they said, well, we just weren't quite sure how to get our heads around this, and it's an environmental issue. We don't do environmental issues. Going back, I guess, to what I was saying at the beginning, Alex, part of the reason that we ignore climate change or that we don't seem to get a grip on it is that people keep thinking of it as something that isn't them, that it's like, that's not what I do. That's not the kind of person I am. And it's something not about the issue itself, but the way we define it and the way we talk about it.
And you say it's not an environmental issue anyway.
I think it's been a huge mistake to call it an environmental issue. I mean, I know why we call it that, and I'm an environmentalist, and of course, I know why I work on it. And the reason for that is it appeared when it came out to look a bit like what environmentalists worked on. So it was caused by pollution, it was caused by fossil fuels, it was caused by lifestyle, the way we live. These things are all strong, as we know, in environmental issues, that the solutions involved living more simply, maybe changing our diet, maybe not eating meat, maybe cycling. You can see how these are all environmental things. And therefore, when the issue came out, the people who moved straight onto it were environmentalists. But of course, it's not these definitions. These are culturally constructed definitions as to whether something is environmental or whether it's social or whether it's economic or whatever it is. And I think this issue is so much bigger than that and so much broader and covers everything across the board. But I think you can talk about it as an environmental issue, but I don't think it is inherently any more environmental than a social rights issue or an economic issue or a resource distribution issue, social justice issue. And as I increasingly do work with people of conservative politics, because I desperately want them to be involved. This has to happen. It's a priority. I talk about it as being a conservative issue. And I say this is vitally important for, you know, for defending your freedom or for, you know, the protection of your property or the things which are concerns for conservative people. Some very interesting work has happened in America with the evangelical movement and the anti-abortion campaign. Some people in the anti-abortion campaign are now running a campaign to talk about climate change as the greatest threat to the unborn child. And I look at this and I go, wow. I mean, I personally, I'm in favor of women's right to choose, and I don't. But that's not the point. The point is that when people of different politics take hold of something, it looks completely different. And you might not like what it looks like, but that's not the point. The point is that the issue shapes and changes when people do it differently. But all along we've said it's environmental, and we stick polar bears up all over it, and you know, it's reported by the environmental correspondent and the environmental column, and it's handled by the environment minister. And this is not only very, very unwise, because it keeps it pushed into this little corner, which appears to be marginal to what we do, but I think it's also very convenient. I think that it's in very much in the interests of vested interests and the interest of government to keep this as this kind of environmental issue, as if, you know, as if it's like dirty air or, you know, smelly ponds or something. It's like, well, yes, when we have a bit more economic development, we can sort that out. And of course it isn't, because this is fundamental to our future.
Well, fortunately, we just had a groundbreaking report in the United States called Risky Business. And I broadcast a press conference with Hank Paulson and Robert Rubin and some Republicans like Michael Bloomberg, who were coming out and saying, this is going to affect our economy. And really, it was sort of, to me, the 1% saying, this is going to affect our wealth and our estates by the sea, and everything that we think we've got could be wiped away by this. It was a little heartening to see that happen.
Yes, and it's an example of how this can be shaped into a different form that speaks to a different audience. And, you know, I repeat what I said before, that for people who have held on to this issue so passionately, including, I imagine, many of the people who listen to your programs, are often, not always, but very often, people of liberal politics, people who are progressive, people who are would regard themselves as being environmentalists, actually feel very, very uncomfortable with the idea that these very powerful, influential, rich people take hold of this. But I would say no. I think this is part of spreading it wider, just as anybody else doing it, just as, you know, African Americans taking it, or just as, you know, human rights people taking it, or anybody who takes it, or communities of color, are going to do something different with it. It's a part of maturing of the issue. The problem is we don't have very long, and we also have very, very deeply embedded social divides around it, such that it, as an issue, it has become politically toxic for many on the right. And that indeed is, I think, is a strategic disaster.
And a great danger to us all. I'm intrigued with your ideas about ethical offsets. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, well, as with so much of my book, you know, my book is called Why Our Brains Are Wired to Ignore Climate Change, for a reason that I'm exploring some very deeply embedded cognitive psychological circuitry. One of these relates to the way that we create stories in our minds. We're really a story animal. We have an incredible capacity for developing stories, actually along templates. And one of the things we do is we develop stories of our own virtue, of our own quality, in which we are the heroes. Partly we do that in order to tell ourselves that we made the right decision, or that we were right, or that the evidence that we see confirms who we are. It's called a confirmation bias. But another way that we do it is to tell ourselves that we're good people. Yes, I describe this as kind of moral offsets. There's a more common psychological term of what's called a moral license. The idea that we tell ourselves a story, but because we've been good in one way, that therefore we can be a little bit naughty in another way. Of course, maybe we're not being a little bit naughty. I mean, you mentioned the Nazis earlier. The pioneering work that was done on moral licensing was done with Nazis who'd been involved, for example, the Holocaust or horrific abuses. And they developed ghastly stories about how they'd done a nice thing here or a nice thing there, and that therefore they were decent people. So there's no proportionality with this. We see it, again, it's very well studied in the health area, that you could see it in any fast food restaurant where people will order, you know, a double bacon cheeseburger and a supersized Diet Coke to go with it. And if you ask them why they're doing that, for Diet Coke is the moral license. It's saying, well, this is all right, I'm not having this fattening drink. And of course, it's all this story. So when it comes to something like climate change, we do it all the time with our behaviors. We say, and people in focus groups, for example, I'm quoting someone from a focus group now, would say, well, I recycle every scrap of paper I have, and that makes me feel a lot better about the amount of flying I do. Well, there's no proportion there. I mean, the recycling paper is not the same as flying to Australia. I mean, it is simply not the same. We also know that people do it in terms of all of their emissions behaviors, including, and actually in my experience, especially people who work on climate change. So one of the very peculiar things, which is my own little experiment, because I spend a lot of my time working with climate scientists, campaigners, educators, is I just ask them where they go on holiday for their, and, you know, for holiday, not just for work, but for holiday. And I'm constantly astonished by how many of them fly long distances for holidays. And I say, well, how can you do that? Because you know we can't live in a world where we all fly around so much. And they start pulling out these little stories that they have about how hard they work and how their work is doing something good for the world, but they're entitled to have some time off. And I guess the point is that it's not to say that they're hypocrites, which would be a very hard thing to call them, and I think would be very unfair, because they're very sincere in terms of their commitment to the issue. I think it's more that they're trying to keep themselves sane, of keeping the anxiety at arm's length. And as I said, they are just as prone. Any scientist, any climate scientist is just the same. They have the same psychological wiring as a climate change denier or as any of the rest of us in between. They're struggling the same way as all of us.
This is a key point. And the thing is, George Marshall, your book title tells us our brains are wired to ignore climate change. And that does sound a bit hopeless. Can we rewire this brain and can we hope to do it in time?
Yes, I'm sorry that the book sounds hopeless. Like any book, we have to capture people's attention with a title. But it's not hopeless because our brains are both wired to ignore things and our brains are wired to pay attention to things. The challenge we have with climate change is that many of the ways it looks and feels and the way we talk about it avoid that attention. And one of the things I haven't talked about yet is, of course, that part of what we do is we look to the people around us. This is also part of our deeply ingrained social wiring. So if we look around and we say, well, I don't see anybody else paying any attention to this. This, of course, happens with silence. One of the reasons we're silent is we look around and we go, well, no one else is talking about it. Then we take our cues from people around us. But, of course, the whole thing can work in reverse. The things that make it hard for us to deal with it can completely turn around and make it possible for us to deal with it. If we look around and we see that the people around us who we like and we trust and appear to be like us are saying this is a huge issue, we need to do something about it, especially if they build up in numbers, and I'm very excited that in September I will be in New York for the People's Climate March, where hopefully there'll be hundreds of thousands of people on the streets. When people see that kind of those numbers there, it creates what we would call a social norm of action that people can see that other people are doing something. All this wiring can go into reverse. Similarly, I think just trying to understand why it's hard for us to understand something is giving us the tools for understanding why and how we can do it better. You know, climate change is not that hard an issue. And I think the proof of that is that there are, around the world, millions of people who are not just concerned about it, but actively involved, doing what they can, agitating, campaigning, and trying to move things along. You know, if we were wired to ignore it, there wouldn't be anyone. I think what is important, however, is to understand that there are certain things which switch those people on, that there are triggers to move from a state of disregard, a kind of denial in the broad sense, just like not accepting something, to a point of conviction. And that those of us who completely get this have moved along that path, and we have to find ways to trigger that process in other people. So we have to find ways of showing them that this is worthwhile and of just moving them along. And I think the lesson, again, from this wiring that we all share is that people don't do that because of arguments. You know, you can't hit someone over the head with a report and say, look, read this, you'll get it. That doesn't work. But actually what works is something much deeper and emotional and social. And it's about how do we get that spirit of shared conviction which moves us along.
From Wales, we're talking with author and longtime climate activist George Marshall about his new book, Don't Even Think About It. George, you've also got a video out with tens of thousands of views on how to speak to workmates, relatives, or acquaintances who deny climate change is happening or say it's not caused by humans. Can you give us a couple of quick pointers from that?
Indeed, I can. The video is how to talk to a climate change denier, which I, of course, everything in the world of videos is about having the right title, but halfway through I apologize and say, look, you know, a lot of this is about respect. Actually, to be honest, calling someone a denier, sometimes people take offense at that. I'm wary of these labels. And I think that respect is very important. It's very much about finding common ground. So recognizing that you may disagree around this issue, but that you have things that you share, things that are important. Because remember that what I was saying earlier, Alex, that what people look for is the cues from people around them who are like them, who they can trust and whose opinion they value. So if you go into a situation, you confront people about how they're wrong, what you're doing is you're emphasizing the difference. I think what's important is to go into a situation and say, you know what, Dave, you know, I really respect the way that you make up your own mind about things. You know, that's fine. You're completely entitled to your opinion. You know, and playing with the fact that you know these people and that there's actually a lot that you have in common. But what I think is very important is that then you go from that, and rather than saying you're wrong because of it, a lot of the climate change communication is very shouty, saying, can't you see your fault? It is the biggest problem that we've ever faced. That's not just confrontational, but it's kind of objectifying the argument. And I think a lot of what I want to explore around the language of, as I was saying before, creating this sense of conviction is finding ways of communicating what you feel and what you're convinced of. That's what will persuade people. So I say if you're speaking with people who are not convinced about climate change, you say, look, you're completely entitled to your views, but for me, I'm convinced. And remember, this is a process of conviction. So you'd say, well, yeah, I used to be doubtful of that, but you know, when we had that major flooding last year, when we had that heat wave, when I saw the chief scientific advisor of the government on the TV saying this was a major problem, it's going to get worse, I said, right, that's it, I'm convinced. I've seen enough, I've heard enough, now I've got it. And I think it's that use of the I to say this is what I believe, this is what's important to me, and to share from a position of what you hold is important.
Great advice, great advice. George, can you give us the link to your blog on climate denial?
Yes, it's climatedenial.org.
Good. Now, Climate Outreach and Information Networker COIN also helped broadcast climate radio with Phil England. He's a host I admire, and I learned from Phil. And the archives for that program are at climateradio.org. Phil seems to be doing occasional climate broadcasts these days, sometimes for Resonance FM in London, which also broadcasts Radio EcoShock. George, what have you heard from Phil lately?
I have to confess, I haven't spoken to Phil for about a year. He's still doing his work. He's done great work. We've been very pleased to work with him and support him since the early days. I think having programs like yours and doing stuff on the radio, especially stuff which is podcasts, is great. You know, it's great that people can go out there and freely access it. And let's face it, Phil's interviewed everybody in the world of climate change.
Yes, he has. I've spoken with him as well. Well, now we're seeing this melting Arctic sea ice. We're seeing extreme rains and flooding, especially in the UK, or massive droughts and fires in sub-Arctic Canada, Alaska, Russia. And many of us hope the public will finally get on board for climate action. But is it possible some people will harden their resistance to the truth instead? How nutty could this get?
I'm afraid the truth is that this could go any number of different ways. I think the important thing to say with climate change is that it is not a matter of, well, it's going to be this or it's going to be that. I think it's a matter of saying that we're not just standing at a crossroads, we're standing and we can see multiple paths reaching out in front of us. One of those paths we know is the one where people reach that point of conviction I was talking about. I've seen enough, that's it, I'm convinced. This is a threat to everything that we all, and I have to stress that all of us, have in common, which is important to us despite our other differences. That language which brings everybody together around a common threat. That is one path. I'm afraid we have to face the facts that there are other paths, and these two can be predicted both in terms of our cognitive wiring that I talk about in my book, but also in terms, unfortunately, of some ugly historical experience. One thing that people can do is that they can quite definitely go into a deeper and harder and more aggressive form of denial where they refuse to face up to it. And we already see this, of course, with how people are responding to extreme weather events. That in any opinion poll, and I've seen polls that have been done in Canada, America, Britain, Australia, people who do not believe in climate change, when they experience a major weather event like a drought or a flood, they come out of it even more convinced that climate change isn't happening. That isn't happening. And the people who do believe in it come out convinced it is happening. In other words, you know, you can throw the most extreme weather at people who don't believe, and they're just persuaded, but it just goes to show that weather can naturally be very extreme. It's very peculiar. People believe what they want to believe, and they take the evidence that they need to reinforce that.
Maybe that explains the reversal of climate policy in Australia recently, and also the fact that people in the U.S. South are very badly hit by climate change. Texas had to sell off their cattle herds practically due to a long-term drought, and yet vote in Republicans who deny climate change, the Tea Party people. So it's a very odd thing to witness this.
Yes, right across the states that are most extremely affected are right across the Midwest in America, and with very, very few exceptions, they have hardcore climate deniers in charge. Not even people who, I'm freely use this word denier now, because these are not just people who aren't convinced about climate change, these are people who go out there and say it's a huge fraud. And we have to recognize that part of what is going on there, I think, is a genuine fear and instability and anxiety amongst people that finds a security in a form of active denial. And just to say, you know, you're asking how nutty this could get. Well, if we're not careful, we know very well from how people respond to conditions of stress or conflict that people can start doing some very crazy things which have nothing to do with climate change. I'm afraid amongst the possible futures for the world are increased conflict, just because we know very well that if people are anxious and distressed, that they, rather than pulling together around climate change, they could pull together around a war, they could pull together around victimizing and scapegoating a minority group in their own population. This is one of the reasons why I say we all have to get involved with this, including people both the left and the right, because to the people on the right, and I had spent some great time actually hanging out with a Texan Tea Party in Texas, about as far right as you can get, and you can imagine in utterly denying climate change. But I kept saying to them, you've got to get to grips with this, because you are so passionate about the idea of freedom from government. Can't you see that if we don't do something about this issue, you're going to lose everything? Nothing is more guaranteed to wave in a dictatorship than major climatic extremes and social collapse. Like, that's why you have to get involved with this.
Well, before we wrap up, George, I'd like to point listeners to another really useful video on your site. It's from a 2009 lecture you gave at the University of West England. I liked it. It's called The Ingenious Ways We Avoid Believing in Climate Change. Is there anything else I've missed, George, that you'd like to say to our listeners?
Oh, gosh, it's hard, isn't it? Because there's so many things. I'd like to say in regards to my book, it will come out in North America in the middle of August. And the thing I guess I wanted to say, which is very important, is I tried to write the book I wanted to read. I am so sick and tired of reading books that just throw lots of information at me about how dire and appalling the world is and how we don't have a hope. Not only did I try to write something that was upbeat, but I tried to write something that was funny and engaging and had stories in it and had some jokes in it and was interesting. Also, I have to say, I was very, very careful that I'm writing about something people don't want to talk about, not to talk about it. So this is probably, I think, fair to say, the first book on climate change that doesn't actually really talk about climate change. I have one chapter at the end that says, oh, by the way, this is why this is important. This is serious. You know, this isn't like some game. This is serious. But trying to get people to write something which is actually, sorry, to read something which is not about, oh my God, we're all going to hell, but actually to say, wow, humans are amazing. We're so amazing. We're so fascinating. We're so smart in some ways and so dumb in others. Aren't we incredible? And I hope, if nothing else, that people read this and they come out with that feeling of, wow, well, this really is a lot deeper and more interesting than I thought it was.
Well, there you have it. Activist George Marshall has done the homework and published an essential new book, Don't Even Think About It, Why Our Brains Are Wired to Ignore Climate Change. You can get more links on the book, including videos and presentations, either from my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info, or even better, from George's website at climateconviction.org. Write that one down, climateconviction.org. Thank you so much for talking with us, George.
You're very welcome. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. If you were thinking of seeing the new climate-aware action film Snowpiercer, our own Jerry Williams has a cautionary review for you. Here's Jerry.
This chaos. 1,000 people in an iron box. 18 years I've hated the train. 18 years I've waited for this moment. This is your world. The train saved humanity.
The engine lasts forever.
The population
must always be kept in balance.
We'll be different when we get there.
What you say?
We take the engine. And we control the world.
What is the time?
Soon.
You've just listened to a soundbite from the new action thriller movie, Snowpiercer. With all we are learning about global climate change, it's important to get the word out, especially through popular culture. So this reviewer welcomed the news that a new feature film based on the effects of climate change was set to arrive in theaters. With the reach and appeal that movies provide, Snowpiercer seemed the perfect medium to explore how humanity can face a calamity whose effects are becoming clearer every day. Unfortunately, I have to report, no such luck. Snowpiercer starts strong with an intriguing premise. A brief screen explanation tells us that in 2014, 79 countries jointly dispersed the chemical CW7 in the upper atmosphere in a desperate attempt to mitigate global warming. The result of this tampering? A cataclysmic climate shift that induced freezing global temperatures, wiped out vegetation, and caused a massive die-off of species. Into this turmoil steps a brilliant, mysterious inventor with a solution, an immense sealed train, the Snowpiercer, manufactured and maintained by the secretive head of Wilford Industries. What is left of humanity has been herded into Snowpiercer. To step outside of its protective shell means a freeze-dried death in minutes. An unknown yet inexhaustible energy source powers the train, which loops endlessly through a moonscape of frozen oil derricks and empty, ruined cities. And this is where the film takes up, 18 years later, where a strict class system divided between winners and losers exists on board the packed train. Snowpiercer makes the case that in the frozen future, the elite will still retain the privileges they presently enjoy, wearing fancy duds, partying, and sampling gourmet sushi. The curriculum of their privileged young people includes heavy doses of fear and loathing propaganda against the lower classes. That is, the tail end section teeming with men, women, and children living in squalor and policed by sullen guards. We never see Wilford, the evil genius who lives in isolation in the train's front engine. We do meet Curtis Everett, a grimy, reluctant leader who launches a plan to take the train by force, reach Wilford, and control the train for the oppressed masses. So the film becomes an odyssey with extreme body count of the downtrodden in search of good food and clean water in the forward train cars. But the film's pace is so breathless that it never pauses to consider, even in flashback, what actually produced the train passengers' desperate situation. By Snowpiercer's superficial logic, you might believe that complete destruction of the ecosphere was merely a fluke of bad planning, rather than the inescapable outcome of human overshoot of resources, poisoning of the atmosphere through unrestrained use of fossil fuels, and unsustainable overconsumption. It would have been worthwhile for the director to explore the causes more thoroughly, if only because proposals for climate experimentation to address the effects of global warming are already underway in our own time. Scientists, under government mandate often, have studied weather modification schemes as varied and crazy as artificial volcanoes, launching deflecting mirrors into space, and locking up carbon dioxide through fertilization of the world's oceans. What to make of a film, then, set in the aftermath of climate change catastrophe that engages no consideration of its causes? And what does any of this mean to us, facing a looming environmental upheaval right now? Snowpiercer's director Bong Joon-ho is a South Korean who has evidently mastered the elements for an international blockbuster film success. Dazzling special effects, nonstop action, and liberal and frequent doses of on-screen violence. What he has failed to produce for this film is a brain. Without providing context, and with no effort to grapple with the issues it raises, Snowpiercer, despite its compelling setting, is little more than an elaborate prison break movie on wheels, with the usual big house movie cliches intact. And in Settling for Less, the director has missed a golden opportunity to frame our generation's most pressing challenge and bring it to a wider audience in a popular entertainment format. I'm still waiting for that kind of movie, one that informs and inspires us both to reflect and to urge appropriate action. But for this reviewer, Snowpiercer is a train to nowhere. This is Jerry Williams for Radio EcoShock.
That was independent radio journalist Jerry Williams with an update from the movie scene. You can be sure that climate-driven media of all kinds will grow as our predicament deepens. You can download all our past programs as free MP3 files, perfect for your phone, iPod, or computer, from our website at ecoshock.org. Don't forget to get more links for this program from the weekly show blog at ecoshock.info, or try things out on our SoundCloud page. We'll go out with another of my poor attempts to create a new wave of electronic music so popular with the younger generation, those who will live with continuous climate challenges. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock, and please join us again next week. This is my new song, Time of Trials. Download it from SoundCloud. Can give when storms come. A human wave can come together. Minds arise as surely as the seas. Divine forms in the minds of many, we believe in the heat. Days flow by to our times of trials, minds in motion with the beat.